Hi.
Morning.
Well, maybe we should have the fans on. It's kind of still in here, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Darla. Microphone. Thank you. A while ago, this is a number of years ago, I was waiting for an elevator with a young man who was a student at a Lutheran seminary. And we were waiting at the elevator, and just as the elevator door opened, I was asking him a question that I'd been wondering about Christian theology. And he said, "This is great." He says, "Because my professor told me that I ought to be able to explain something like this in the length of time it takes to go up so many floors in an elevator." Right? And so he did. And I don't remember what he told me. But I was just so fascinated by this idea of being able to explain something in the length of time it takes to go up so many floors in an elevator. And, you know, in Zen, we have elevator door dharma. We can say something coherent about Zen in the amount of time it takes for an elevator door to open or close. One example of that is in the book Crooked Cucumber, David Chadwick talks about when he was a young man listening to Suzuki Roshi talk at Tassajara. And, you know, he gave this long, very elegant, eloquent talk and asked for questions. And David raised his hand and said, "You know, Zen is so vast and it's so huge and it's so overwhelming. Can you just put it in a nutshell for me?" And the other students kind of looked askance at him. Suzuki thought about it for a minute, and then he said, "Everything changes." Everything changes, which I thought was really good. And then a year or two ago, one of the times that Norman Fisher was here, he was talking about that story, and he said that he didn't call it an elevator door dharma, but his short explanation of Zen, he said he could do it in four words. And his four words, does anybody remember this? Oh, you got to remember this. Don't make things worse. Isn't that great? Don't make things worse. That was wonderful. So I have one that this is my personal Zen instruction that I use for myself. And it's two words. It's pay attention. Pay attention. And I mean pay attention in a gentle, kindly way. I'm not talking about scolding kind of paying attention. We're not hitting the hand with a ruler here. It's pay attention. And I arrived at that one because of our location here on the shore of Lake Calhoun. Over the years, I've seen lots and lots of people walking around the lake who, it appears to me, get all the way around the lake and never notice the lake because they are so busy doing something else. One time, and I can hardly believe I really saw this, but at the time I said, "Pay attention, you are really seeing this." There was this was back in the rollerblading days, and I saw a young man rollerblading, and he had his dog on a leash, so he was rollerblading his dog, and he had on earbuds, so he was listening to something, and he was holding a book in front of him. He was holding a book, and I think that's a fair metaphor for how we go through our lives, you know? We're rollerblading along our lives with, you know, while we're walking our dog, while we're, you know, he should have had a candy bar too. He should have been eating too. But that's what we do, you know. We rollerblade through our lives like that. And we distract ourselves from the important things, from the beautiful things, from the mundane things even, by allowing our attention to be scattered in four directions, or in the 10 directions maybe. But our Zen practice isn't like that. Our Zen practice is all about paying attention. So here's an old Zen story starring Ikkyu, who was a 15th century Rinzai Zen priest. He was a poet, and he was a calligrapher. He was a noted calligrapher, and he was a wild man, but they don't talk about that. But if you read his poems, you'll find out. This is in the front of your bulletin today. A visitor said to Ikkyu, "Please write something of great wisdom for me." You know we're in trouble right there. You know something's going to happen, right? Visitor said to Ikkyu, "Please write something of great wisdom for me." Ikkyu picked up his brush and wrote one word, attention. The visitor said, "Is that all?" Ikkyu picked up his brush again and he wrote, "Attention, attention." The visitor became irritable. "That doesn't seem profound or subtle to me." In response, Ikkyu wrote simply, "Attention, attention, attention." The visitor got pretty frustrated at this point, and he demanded, "What does this word attention mean?" And Ikkyu replied gently, very gently, "Attention means attention." I added the word gently in there. It wasn't in the original. But I think it's important that that word be in there. I'll talk about that a little bit more later. So Ikkyu's visitor said that he wanted something wise and profound. But I think that what he really wanted was an impressive Ikkyu calligraphy that he could hang on his wall, in my opinion. And I think that Ikkyu wasn't being recalcitrant with this answer. He wasn't being iconoclastic. He wasn't being like all Zen with him, you know? I think it's exactly what he meant, attention. And I mean, he said it three times. I think that he very simply meant attention. And in writing that, he gave the visitor something that was much greater than what he asked for. He gave him what he needed rather than what he thought he wanted. So you might not think that it's very profound or deep, or you might see something really deep in it, I don't know. But it's direct, and it's straightforward, and it's useful, and it's kind. At least in my version, it's kind. When I teach new people Zazen, when I teach introduction, I get the feeling sometimes that they can't quite believe that the basic instruction really is just sit down, straighten your back, get yourself in a comfortable position, upright position that you can hold, and then pay attention to whatever happens in the next moment, moment after moment. Obviously, there's a lot more to be said about Zazen if you want, but basically, that's what we're doing. Basically, that's what we're doing. We sit upright, we don't move, and we don't strive for something other than what we're experiencing right now. We're just alert to anything that happens or anything that comes up. Excuse me. And we do that moment by moment in every moment until the bell rings. And in our lives, of course, we do that moment by moment by moment as we encounter our lives until the great bell rings, right? Until there aren't any more moments. It's very simple. It's very simple. And when people talk to me about issues that they have in meditation or they have questions, far and away, the one that I hear the most often is, I can't meditate because my mind is too noisy. I sympathize. I have a noisy mind too. But they'll say, I can't quiet it down, and how am I supposed to meditate with all that chatter going on? There's a lot of commotion in there. When I was a kid, I spent a fair amount of time in barnyards, and there were a lot of hens around. And if you spend any time around hens, you know that if they are awake, they are going, bawk, 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 bawk. I'm not going to stand up and do the rest of the imitation, although I could. You know, but that's what our minds are like. The difference being that we can't understand what the hens are saying. We don't know what the content of it is. But when we're sitting here, we can get really pulled away by the content of what we're saying, right? The most helpful, one of the most helpful meditation instructions I ever got was way, way after I had learned how to meditate originally. And I've been meditating for quite a while at this point. And Tim gave me this meditation instruction that was really pretty deep and profound for me. It really kind of turned me around. We were in a retreat, and I went upstairs to see him in a Doksan in a private interview. And I was telling him, I was explaining to him how my mind was so busy and I just couldn't get it to shut up and bawk, 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 bawk. And he said, well, I guess today you're just going to be sitting with busy mind. And it, that, you know, what an unbelievably simple thing to say. And it's embarrassing for me to tell you that story, because this was, I mean, I'd been ordained for several years at this point. And you would think that by that time I would have understood this. But it was very helpful. So it's kind of an embarrassing story. But the reason that I'm telling you this, you know, it's a good thing just between us, right? The reason I'm saying it is in case anybody here has ever said to themselves or to someone else, I can't quiet down my mind, I am the worst meditator ever, or what I do isn't meditation, it's waiting for that bell to ring. But you can just sit with busy mind, and you can just observe that mind. You might say you could just be aware of that mind without getting caught by the content of it. You know, and this goes for all different kinds of mental states. You know, you might be sitting with lonely mind or ecstatic mind, or grandiose mind. But it, you can be fascinated by your busy mind just by being aware of it. And then, if you notice yourself getting pulled away by the content, you just bring yourself back. You just bring yourself back. Gently, gently. I think I say that more often than anything else, and I've heard it so often, and yet somehow we don't believe it. We don't believe it. I don't know why. It's pretty easy. So that's the instruction we give. Anytime you get pulled away by something in your mind or something in your body, you know, a backache, you just drop it and you come back. Attention, attention, attention. Gently, gently, gently. And busy mind, you know, it isn't the only mind that we might encounter, you know. Things can be very surprising and refreshing and illuminating sometimes. Sometimes when I'm the doshi, the presiding priest here on Monday nights, and it's very quiet. And sometimes there's only a few of us there. And it can be so quiet and spacious in here. It's just wonderful. It's just wonderful. And that quiet, spacious sitting is exactly the same as the sitting with the spinning mind. It's the same thing. You're just being there with it, whatever it is. Whatever it is. Mostly, I think what we're doing is training ourselves how to stay right here and not turn away. Not turn away from our lives, you know. We're teaching ourselves that we can be here with whatever difficult thing happens. We're demonstrating ourselves that we're stronger and braver than we might think, than we might have imagined. Because we all want to be able to take whatever it is that we learn or develop on the cushion, off the cushion too. We want to be able to see more clearly. We want to be able to respond in an appropriate, helpful way to whatever comes up in our lives, whatever we're faced with. So in order to do that, when we're out in the hubbub, when we're out on our roller blades with our dog and our sandwich, in order to be able to do it there, it's very helpful to train ourselves to be able to do it here, where we're only doing one thing. Blanche Hartman talked about that. Blanche Hartman is the one of the former abbots of San Francisco Zen Center. She's retired now. And they put together a book, quotations, excerpts from her Dharma talks from over the years, and it's wonderful. It's called Seeds for a Boundless Life, Zen Teachings from the Heart. We have it here in our library. And here's what she says about that. Excuse me. She says, Zazen is really practice about living in the present so that we can actually manifest this precious life in a way that feels satisfying to us, a way that is consonant with our inner understanding of the Dharma, or the truth. And she goes on to say that practice can help us to welcome our life as it arrives moment by moment, to meet it as fully as we can, being as open to it as we can, being as ready for whatever arises as we can, and meeting it wholeheartedly. Wholeheartedly, there's another wonderful word. Gently, kindly, wholeheartedly. So we need to apply that attention in a way that's open-hearted. Sometimes I imagine my heart actually, you know, I visualize it actually opening up when I sit on the cushion. Dogen Zenji talks about that in his fascicle, Instructions to the Cook, which we have several copies of in our library. This is part of the Ehei Shingi. It's the instructions for Zen life in a monastery, which is surprisingly relevant to our life now. But anyway, we have this book. It's called From the Zen Kitchen to Enlightenment, Refining Your Life. And it's got Dogen's fascicle, Instructions to the Cook, in it, with commentary by Uchiyama Roshi. He talks about being very careful and paying very close attention to everything that happens in a cook's day. He tells them in excruciating detail how to prepare the rice, you know, starting with you know, washing it and picking out the little stones, and the attitude of mind that you should have with it, and the way that you should keep in mind all of the beings who are going to be fed by it, where it came from. So it's a very kind of spacious, but also very concentrated paying attention. Excuse me. And near the end, he talks about the qualities of mind that we can do this with. And he talks about three that he calls magnanimous mind and grandparent mind and joyful mind. And here's what Uchiyama says in his commentary about Dogen's magnanimous mind. He says, it's like an ocean or a mountain, calm and steady, yet accepting and nourishing countless beings and situations without differentiation. The ocean is serene because it accepts the many rivers without resisting. So he's talking about a spacious mind. He's talking about one that understands our really deep fundamental interconnectedness. So magnanimous mind is when we're sitting here in Zazen and it's I and all beings are sitting here together. We sit here together. Even if I'm the only one in the room, I with all beings am sitting here together. It's open-hearted, it's imperturbable, it's taking the long view. And when I'm in the kitchen, you know, when we're the Tenzo, we have a couple of people here who've been Tenzo. When you're Tenzo, when you're the head cook, when I'm cooking the rice, I'm just cooking the rice. I'm just paying really close attention to cooking the rice. Everyone in the dining hall will appreciate that, will appreciate you for that later. But while I'm paying attention to every activity that I'm doing, paying close attention, I'm also doing it with all beings. So that's magnanimous mind. And a grandparent mind is the grandma who loves you and wants only the best for you and gives you the benefit of the doubt no matter what and talks to you in soothing, encouraging tones all the time. You know, if I'm sitting in a retreat and it's day three and I've got a twinge in my back, that's what I like to call it, a twinge. My back is killing me. So I have a little twinge in my back. And grandmotherly mind will say, oh, sweetie, you have a little twinge in your back. I'm really sorry. Straighten up a little bit. You'll be all right. Yeah. Or maybe I have been sitting cross-legged too much and I have a bad pain in my knee. Grandmotherly mind might say, oh, sweetie, your knee really hurts. You should very quietly change your position because I care about you. That's grandmotherly mind. Grandmotherly mind also, when the person who's sitting next to you is doing something just beyond obnoxious, something that is so terrible, you cannot believe it, you know, like breathing audibly. You know? It's a third day of Sesshin and you just cannot believe they are still breathing like that. Grandmotherly mind, you know, steps in and says, sweetie, Amy's your friend. You love Amy. She's been sitting next to you this whole time. You and Amy are sitting this session together. Let her breathe. She's always on your side. giving you whatever you need. You know, when Tim gave me that wonderful instruction of just sit with busy mind, when he did that, that was grandmotherly teaching right there. Tim is a very grandmotherly teacher. I really appreciate him about that. The third one that Dogen describes is joyful mind. And Uchiyama says, this is the joy that comes from deep in our hearts, even in the midst of difficulty. The joy that comes from deep in our hearts, even in the midst of difficulty. You really notice this one at times of grief. Let's go right to the most difficult thing. Times of grief, like at a funeral when everybody's heart is just wide open, you know. And at a time like that, I find that we just so deeply appreciate everybody else there, because we've been faced with mortality, and we can see how insubstantial life is, right? We can see how precarious it is. So right in the middle of that extreme sadness and sorrow and disbelief, really, you know, there's just this little flame of joyous, joyful appreciation for everybody around you. Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? You felt that? It lasts, I find it lasts about 3 days. And I'm always sorry when it starts to dissipate. You can call it back up. You can always, always maintain a joyful mind. This month is the 20th anniversary of the day that I walked into my first Sangha. I've been thinking about that. And before that, I sat alone for a couple of years. And I have to say that sitting with Sangha and practicing with the Sangha has been one of the greatest sources of joyful mind in my life. You know? It's really one of the greatest sources. These days, the main thing that I do around here is I'm the sewing teacher. So I teach people how to sew rock suits, these little versions of Buddha's robe. And when people are preparing to be ordained, they sew their large robe themselves. And I help them with that. When people who meet me somewhere else and know that I'm a priest at MZMC ask me what I do there, it's a question I get. What do you do there exactly? I tell them that the main thing that I do is help people understand how to take their meditation practice, their zazen practice, off their cushion and into what we call the rest of our life. I used to tell them that I'm the sewing teacher, but it gave them the complete wrong idea. It did. And so I thought about it for a while. What is it I'm really teaching here? And that's what it is. You know, sewing and, you know, cooking the rice and rollerblading around the lake. It's all zazen activity. It's all zazen activity. And if my students, if my sewing students learn that one thing, I'm a happy girl. I'm a happy girl. So, you know, when they get frustrated with their sewing, when they get frustrated with it, I'm right there next to them with what I hope is grandmotherly mind. It might be chirpy cheerleader mind, I'm not sure. Saying, you know, it's just, look at that frustration. It's just frustration. Boy, just like being on the cushion, sometimes frustration arises, you know. Now just get back to your stitching. Now take the next stitch and the next stitch and let go of frustration. Or sometimes they'll kind of zone out while they're sewing and they'll kind of sew along. And sometimes when they're sewing an ocasa, they'll sew the ocasa to their shirt. Don't laugh at people who do that. I've done that myself. Not lately. But so sometimes, you know, they'll kind of zone out and that'll happen. Who hasn't done that in zazen? Who hasn't sewn their ocasa to their shirt in zazen? Anybody here? Don't raise your hand. I don't want to know. To your finger. His has blood on it, on the back, yeah. Right? Yeah, Benton. So anyway, they'll drift off sometimes and they'll sew their ocasa to their shirt. And you know, okay, you drifted off. Now let's just pull those stitches out. Let's pull them all the way back. Now let's come back to this stitch and this stitch and this stitch and this stitch. It's just like zazen. Before, when we're gearing up to teach a new sewing class, every single time I think in the weeks before a new sewing class starts, somebody, usually several somebodies, will kind of pull me over during tea and say, listen, I have never threaded a needle in my life. And they really don't believe that they can do this. Just like with meditation, you hear this all the time. You know, I'm too antsy. I couldn't possibly do that. I couldn't possibly do that. But it's okay. One fold at a time, one stitch at a time, one breath at a time, with your teacher and your sangha here beside you. Sure you can. Sure you can. And at the end, those same people are so pleased that they could do this. And they're pleased and surprised. And sometimes when we have the ceremony where they receive the rakusus, once in a while somebody's parent will come up to me and tell me how surprised they are that their son or daughter could do this. I say, yeah, they're great. They were great. So here's a story. Maybe it's a koan. It's a koan story about sewing. And it stars Dongshan and Shenshan, who had practiced together for years and years and years and years. Shenshan was mending clothes with a needle and thread. And Dongshan asked, what are you doing? And Shenshan said, mending. And Dongshan said, how are you mending? And Shenshan answered, one stitch is like the next. And Dongshan exclaimed, after 20 years of practice, that is all you can say? Shenshan asked, okay then, how do you mend? And Dongshan said, as if the whole world were exploding. There's a saying, we sit in zazen like our hair was on fire. My first teacher used to say that all the time, and every time he thought it, I would say, that is why you've shaved your head, isn't it? That's why you've shaved your head. As if the whole world were exploding. And any commentary will tell you that Dongshan, having said that, is the winner of this koan. He wins. Because what he's saying there is, with the kind of attention and stick-to-itiveness and determination that you would have in the middle of the world exploding. So Dongshan wins, but I would like to advocate for Shenshan. You know, I've had students who sew like the world is exploding, and it's not always such a good thing. When Shenshan says, one stitch is like the next, I think that what he's saying is that he gives the same attention to each stitch as the one before or after it. One breath is like the next means that whether we are taking this breath in grief for our best friend who died 20 years ago, or whether we're taking this breath in some kind of deep samadhi, or whether we're taking this breath with busy mind, you know, one breath is the same as the next, actually. Just breath. Just so. When I was sewing my first okesa for ordination, I sewed with two other people, Susan Nelson and I sewed together, and Susan Hegler sewed with us also. And Susan Hegler has this wonderful story about how we would go every week over to Tomoy's house. Tomoy Katagiri is our sewing teacher. We'd go over there and sew with her every week. And so Susan Hegler, when she was finishing her okesa, she was just getting ready to put in the last stitch, and she asked Tomoy, you know, is there anything special about this stitch? Is there anything, you know, is there a ritual? Is it, you know, I don't know what she asked. Is there something about this stitch? And Tomoy just said, first stitch, same as last stitch. That's true. First stitch, same as last stitch. We're doing the same thing in Zazen 2 seconds before the bell rings as we are 10 minutes before that, 5 minutes before that, any point in Zazen. We're doing the same thing. We're just breathing. We're just coming back. We're just paying kind, gentle, open-hearted attention. So, my entire elevator door Dharma talk is two words. It's pay attention. And everything after that was commentary. And I am guessing that some of you might have an elevator door Dharma expression or a commentary on attention or something else you'd like to say or ask? Anybody?
When I'm here, I can sort of be in the moment because that's what we do. And there are actions that can support that. But this competition between being and doing is in a different relationship when I'm out in the world. And the doing is so absorbing that I forget that I have to remember to be. And it keeps diminishing, as you said. And you said your work is to take the work here and move it into your life. What thoughts, suggestions, how do you support people in that work to fight this battle between the doing and attending?
It's the same thing that you do on the cushion. You remind yourself, remind yourself, remind yourself. I have a practice. My bus from here goes home via the lake. And I have a practice of every time we're by the lake, I don't allow myself to do anything else but look at the lake, right? And on the bus, I don't allow myself to look at my smartphone, which just kills me because everybody else is doing it. While I'm on the bus, I'm practicing by looking at everybody else on the bus, right? When you're at the gym, you know, you're doing this, just do this. And when you find yourself drifting away, you know, just come back to your barbell zazen. And sometimes, you know, at work or at play, you become so absorbed in something that you're doing that everything else kind of stops and you're in this wonderful kind of zone. And that's zazen. That's okay. That's wonderful, right? Does that help?
Sort of? Yeah, it's just hard.
It is hard. It is so simple, and it's so hard. It's so hard. Yeah, Phoebe.
I just wanted to raise a question, a query about this, and consider that maybe there is no conflict, and maybe it isn't hard, or doesn't have to be hard.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, when you were first describing being very absorbed in doing, I thought, oh, that sounds wonderful. Because when you're really absorbed in anything, like wholeheartedly, it's kind of like yourself disappears because mm-hmm. it's just the doing of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you were describing that I thought was maybe experienced negatively to me sounded like great. You know?
Yeah. I mean,
to be that absorbed in anything is basically zazen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like, and we think that we should be doing something else, or it should be some other way. Often we think that, and that's exactly the problem, that we think things should be different than they are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have a judgment about me.
Yeah. When I worked for 15 years as a technical writer, and I wrote online help and computer manuals and stuff, and I did a lot of tech writing zazen. You know, you get so absorbed in it, and this is what I'm doing right here, right now. And yeah, like you think about an ice skater doing one of those, or a ballerina doing one of those circles, you know, there is nothing else going on for them right then. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Yeah, Mark.
There's a thing that Usho said that I always found really helpful, and it's a later mantra. It's compassion and wisdom is simply being careful and kind.
Compassion and wisdom is being careful and kind. Yeah.
I often will just say that to myself. Careful and kind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they come together. They come together just like this. Yeah. Yeah.
I would like to share one of my mantras.
Okay.
Something that I say to myself on the cushion.
Okay.
And that's chew.
Chew.
Chew. Just masticate, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that one bite doesn't taste like the next. Something I'm grateful for. To put another facet on the one stitches. Like that.
Yeah. Chew. Oh, I like that one. I like that one. And swallow.
I was going to add, when we were talking about being absorbed in doing. But so what I found is that there are certain things that I do that it's a lot easier for me to get carried away in my thoughts and not be present. So I try to consciously pick a couple of those things to remember to try and be mindful of as I do them. Like folding the laundry
mm-hmm.
is a good one.
Yeah.
So doing folding zazen mm-hmm. is something I wouldn't normally be really present when I do.
Yeah.
But I've tried to turn that around. So maybe that would help in certain cases.
Yeah.
Just picking a few different things and trying to flex that muscle.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And a mantra that I like is, this is it.
This is it. Oh, that's wonderful. I like that. Three words. This is it. Thich Nhat Hanh has a practice. He says, washing the dishes to wash the dishes, right? Folding the laundry. Just folding the laundry. Not folding the laundry to get this over with so I can go have my life. But just folding, and you know, when you do that, it's a wonderful activity. I learned that with ironing Oriyoki cloths. You know, if you iron Oriyoki cloths in front of the TV, it is really drudgery, but at least you've got the TV. But if you just iron, you can really sort of enjoy the steam of the iron coming up, and you can take some pleasure in the wrinkles getting steamed out, and it's wonderful. Way better than, you know, folding the laundry on your rollerblades. While you're eating, yes, and listening to something on your earphone. Oh. Yeah.
I'm just curious if you have thoughts on meaning or feeling behind the first of the two words, pay.
Pay.
You didn't talk about it.
Oh. Do you have thoughts on that?
Honoring comes to mind.
Honoring. Yeah. Yeah, pay attention is a figure of speech, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I like that. Honoring what's happening right now with my attention. You know? That's it, isn't it? It's longer than an elevator door closing, but you can always stick your hand in the elevator door. Over and over, mindfully, for as long as it takes. Thank you. I like that.
Rosemary, I'd like to thank you for your talk. It's been like a guided meditation for me.
Uh-huh.
It's bringing me back to the most basic, wonderful practice. Thank you.
Thank you. Someone at Benton.
Fred Warner posted on Facebook a few weeks ago, meditating without thoughts is like exercising without sweat.
I want to say that into the mic in case it... Brad Warner posted on Facebook, meditating without thoughts is like exercising without sweat. Oh, that Brad Warner. That's very good. I think one more maybe, or we can just go to announcements. Maybe we have some announcements.
We have several announcements.